Part 2 has been cut short because I cannot find much information on the constellations around Hydra. I mean, right under, like, the middle of Hydra is an air pump, so I don't know. I don't know. I mean, if they can't think of it, neither can I. But I'll just continue on some other numbers in the possibilities of this calling by chance or codes in the Bible. I'll give more codes in the Bible when I learn Hebrew, I promise. I'll probably be 15 or 16, but I'll still be doing blogs by then, okay? Alright, let's go. You're gonna have to keep track of the part threes. If it's like a year later I put part three, that's fine. It applies. I might put an album anyway, so yeah, that'll happen, okay. Real quickly, we'll jump from Peter Ruckman to Robert W. Fay, like I said we would in our last one. Okay, so God claims, he claims that God has chosen the number 37 as his fingerprint. There are several other thematic numbers, each one designating something very special, but we will only look at the number 37 for now. We found that when we added up the values of Greek letters in Jesus, the total was 888. When we divide 37 into JAA, we get 24. We can also express this as follows. 888 equals 37 times 24. The sum of the letters in Godhead was 962. When we divide this by 37, we get 26. Or we can say 962 equals 37 times 26. The numerical value of the Greek letters instead of man was 2960. When we divide by 37, we get 80. When we added up the values of Hebrew letters in the earth, we found that their sum was 296. 37 times 8. To illustrate a few of the countless thousands of times the number 37 appears as God's fingerprint in the Bible, he has listed some of these below. We won't go through each calculation, but just give the numerical value of the letters expressed as a multiple of 7. 2 Corinthians 4:4. God Christ, who is the image of God. That's 37 times 105. Same passage. Image of God. 37 times 37. Christ. Same passage. 37 times 36. Same passage again. God. 37 times 15. 2 Thessalonians 1. Lord. 27 times 37. Mark 12:29. The Lord God is one Lord. 37 times 27. Oh wait, 72. 37 times 72. The Lord God is one Lord. Colossians 3:24. The Lord Christ. 37 times 120. Revelation 22:20. Lord Jesus. 37 times 33. Philemon. Oh wait, just a minute. Not Philemon. Philippians 2:9. And gave him a name which is above every name, 37 times 108. 2 Peter 1:17. 17 is the number of leadership. This is my beloved son, 37 times 111. Luke 20:13. My beloved son, 37 times 42. 1 John 4:9. God sent his only begotten son to the world, equals 37 times 120. 1 John 4, the same passage, his only begotten son. 37 times 54. Galatians 2:20, the Son of God. 37 times 66. And John 10:36, I am the Son of God. Equals 37 times 54. As you can see, the thematic number 37 seems to appear whenever God wants to point out something very special. And this happens throughout the Bible, both in Hebrew of the Old Testament and Greek of the New Testament. Could this be a mere coincidence? I'll let you decide. He computed the probability of only the 18 features of 37 we have examined. The probability of just these 18 multiples of the number 37 appearing by chance is 1 out of million, billion, trillion, quadrillion, quintillion, sextillion. Alright, just a minute. 1 in 30 septillion. Oh no, this is just a coincidence according to you atheists. Oh, yeah. Oh, that's just a coincidence. Yeah. Whatever. I don't really think... I mean, come on. That's ridiculous. Alright. Ivan, before we go to 7 with him, Ivan Panin, the father of Bible numerics. Although many scholars through the ages have been fascinated by the numbers which appear in the scriptures, it was not until Ivan Panin's exhaustive work on this subject that the full extent of the fantastic numerical design to be found in the Bible could begin to be appreciated. Ivan Panin was born in Russia in 1885. As a young man, he was active in plots against the Tsarist government and was arrested and eventually exiled. After continuing his studies in Germany, he came to the United States and entered Harvard University. Mr. Panin became a master of literary criticism, writing and lecturing widely. Ivan Panin was an agnostic, but his work with the classical languages and in textual criticism demanded a detailed study of the Greek New Testament. In 1890, he read a passage in the Greek Gospel of John. He made a discovery, which was to launch a lifelong investigation of Bible numerics, ultimately revealing the intricate, unique, and detailed numerical design which runs through the entire Bible. For 52 years until his death in 1942, Panin labored from 12 to 18 hours each day, accumulating over 40,000 pages of material on Bible numerics. His published books are still available today. I strongly suggest that if what is presented here has aroused your interest, you will obtain these excellent volumes for continued study of this fascinating subject. One of the many features which Panin discovered in the scriptures has to do with the repetition of the number 7. In the last chapter, this guy said that the last chapter he would examine Genesis 1:1 and see how these were indeed the words of God which Adam had written down. Let us do that now. Our Bible begins with a simple statement. It is, I believe, a direct quotation written down by Adam, or of the exact words which God spoke to him as God explained what he had done before he created Adam. Genesis 1:1 says, "In the beginning God created the heaven and the earth." You will find the Hebrew words of this text to be exactly the same in any copy of a Hebrew Old Testament. So, let us now examine what Dr. Panin found in one short verse concerning the repeated incidence of the number 7. The number of words in Genesis 1:1 is exactly 7. The total... And Hebrew, this is Hebrew, guys. The total numerical value of the three nouns, God, heaven, and earth, is 777, 111 times 7. The numerical value of the verb created is 29 times 7. The numerical value of the first, middle, and last Hebrew letters in this verse is 19 times 7. The numerical value of the first and last letters of the 7 words of this verse is 199 times 7. The numerical values of the first and last letters of the first and last words is 71 times 7. The numerical value of the first and last letters of the remaining words is 128 times 7. The numerical value of the participle, eth, in the article, the, each of which appears twice in the verses, is 58 times 7. The numerical value of the last letters of the first and last words is 70 times 7. The total number of Hebrew letters in the 7 words of this is 4 times 7. The number of Hebrew letters in the beginning God created is 2 times 7. The number of Hebrew letters in the heaven and heavens and the earth, or the heaven and the earth. I'm sorry. The number of Hebrew letters in the beginning God created is 2 times 7. And the number of Hebrew letters in the heaven and the earth is 2 times 7. The number of letters in the first object, the heavens, is 7. Or the heaven. This guy doesn't use King James. The heaven, 7. The number of letters in the second object, and the earth, 7. The number of letters in the three reading words, God, heaven, and earth. Let's see. Heaven. The number of letters in the three reading words, God, heaven, and earth, is 2 times 7. The number of letters in the four remaining words of this verse is 2 times 7. The shortest word of this verse is in the middle. The number of letters in this word and the word to its right is exactly 7. The number of letters in this middle word and the word to its left is exactly 7. Kind of gets you to thinking, huh? In this one verse of only 7 words, we find 18 separate features of the number 7. calculating the probability of these 18 instances appearing strictly by chance of Genesis in Genesis 1:1, we find the probability is the order of one chance in 10 quintillion. 37 in Genesis 1:1. So let's see. The numerical value of all the Hebrew letters in Genesis, Genesis 1:1, is 37 times 73. The numerical value of the Hebrew letters in the earth is 37 times 8. The numerical value of the Hebrew letters in God, heaven, and the earth is 37 times 21. And the only seven Hebrew words comprising the very first verse in the Bible, we have found God's fingerprint three times. The probability of this occurring by chance in these first seven words is an order of one chance out of 50,000. All right, so you might say one out of 50,000. Well, that's still big. It just doesn't seem big from the 10 quintillion, 30 septillion. I don't think I really have to compare it that much. All right. There are some in chapter two of that book. We were able to examine a unique system of numbers which God has chosen to appear in the numerical values of words, phrases, and entire passages in the original Greek and Hebrew texts. The number 37 has a very special place in these numbers, and I call it God's fingerprint. When Jesus came to earth, he came as the image of God. Then we add up the values of Greek letters in the image of God. We get 37 times 7. So let's look at even more graphic illustrations of how Jesus is connected with this number. The number is the result of adding the Greek letter of these words. You know, this proves Jesus is God. 37 is found in Jesus. And we are going to find where that is. So, I'm just going to crawl in my bed, if you must know. Alright, Jesus, 37 times 24. So 888 is 37, is 88 divided by 37 is 24. Christ, 37 times 40. Jesus Christ, 37 times 64. Messiah, 37 times 25. And that's alone pretty hard to be a coincidence. See, in his last 24 hours, Jesus had to fulfill 31 prophecies which had been written hundreds of years before in the Old Testament. I'm sure that you are familiar with the accounts of the last day when he was seized and taken before Pilate for trial after Judas had betrayed him, crucified, and buried. Keeping what you know about that day in mind, let's examine these prophecies from the Old Testament and compare them with what actually happened. He would be betrayed by a friend, by Psalm 55, 12-14, and 41:9. He would be sold for 30 pieces of silver, Zechariah 11:2. The money would be used to buy a potter's field, Zechariah 11:13. By the way, 11, disaster, 13. Never mind. Well, you know, it's not a coincidence. His disciples would forsake him, Zechariah 13:7. He would be accused by false witnesses, Psalms 35:11 and 109:2. He would be beaten and spat upon, Isaiah 50:4-6. He would remain silent before his accusers, Isaiah 53:7. He would be wounded and bruised, Isaiah 53:5, 6, and 10. He would be nailed to a cross, Psalm 109:24. His hand and feet would be pierced, Psalm 22:16. He would die between two thieves, Isaiah 53:12. He would bear shame, reproach, and dishonor, Psalm 69:19. He would pray for his executioners, Isaiah 53:12 and Psalm 119:4. People would shake their heads at him, Psalm 119:25 and 33:7. He would be ridiculed, Psalm 22:8. People would be astonished, Psalm 22:17 and Isaiah 52:14. His garments would parted and lots cast for them, Psalms 22:18. He would thirst, Psalms 69:3. He would be given gall and vinegar to drink, Psalm 69:21. He would cry out, "My God, why hast thou forsaken me?" Psalm 22:1. 1. He would commit his soul to God, Psalm 31:5. He would give a cry of victory and triumph, Psalm 22:31. His friends would stand far off, Psalm 38:11. His bones would not be broken, Psalms 34:20. In Exodus 24:46. Now, I mean, maybe if Psalms is not far back enough, Exodus is. His side would be pierced, Zechariah 12:10. His visage would be marred, Isaiah 52:14. His heart would be broken, Psalms 22:14. Darkness would cover the land, Amos 8:9. He would be buried in a rich man's tomb, Isaiah 53:9. He would be cut off, but not for himself, Daniel 9:26. He would be the Lamb of God, Isaiah 53:7. Remember, all of these prophecies were in the Old Testament. But when we read them, it is exactly as though we were reading the gospel narrative of what actually happened. The odds against one man fulfilling all 31 of these prophecies is staggering. One chance out of 431,696,000. I kind of think it would be more. But Jesus fulfilled another prophecy, the most important of them all, and in doing so truly about became the one of whom all the prophecies refer to. God raised him from the dead. Psalm 16:10. In his lifetime on earth, there were a total of over 300 of them. The odds against one man doing this in one lifetime is 8 times is one chance in 8 × 10^132 power. 132 zeros at him. Times 8. Astonishing odds, but Jesus did it. No one except that true Son of God could possibly have fulfilled all these prophecies. He might say, you can't prove these really happening these times. You can prove what happened, what were ancient writings. You can. Like by markings or something like that. But anyway, I don't know why you can overlook this. That's why I'm reporting this, you know, in this book. This guy's a Christian numerologist, and so he's just doing. All right. God's special day, the 17th day of Nisan. In studying the Bible over the course of many years, it struck him that there was one particular day which God seemed to be calling to our attention. On this day, many important events occurred, and he decided to make a thorough search through the Bible and record these major incidents. This day is the 17th day of the Jewish month of Nisan. In this book, we saw that different people use different methods of measuring time and blah blah blah. Each year was actually only 360 days, but to keep this in accord with the seasons, an extra short month was periodically added with the calendar revised on a 19-year cycle. So the 17th day of Nisan was, this happened first when it landed, the ark landed in the mountains of Ararat. So we'll just say the normal. Now people will say, you know, this doesn't mean anything. So just one chance out of 360. That's the normal. Because that's any, okay, it's like any, every day if this something happened, you say, how could this happen? It's one day out of 360. It's like, well, it has to happen one of those days, you know? So, one chance out of 360 if there are 360 days in the Hebrew year. So, it's pretty cool that, you know, so that's the first time this 17th day of Nisan is here. The night on which the firstborn of Egypt were killed was the first Passover, for the avenger was to pass over the house of the Hebrews. They were instructed to kill a lamb and put blood from it on the upper doorpost and the two side posts. This was a sign to the Lord's angel to pass by the house and not kill the firstborn of it, nor the sheep, nor goats, or cattle of the owner of that house. The lamb was then to be roasted for the Passover meal. Exodus 2:4 tells us, "And this day shall be unto you for a memorial, and you shall keep it a feast to the Lord throughout your generations. We shall keep it a feast by an ordinance forever." This day was 14 Nisan. It began at sundown. That night the angel of the Lord smote every Egyptian firstborn, including the son of Pharaoh. Next morning a great cry went up in Egypt as they realized what had happened. Pharaoh called for Moses and Aaron and told them to take Hebrews and leave Egypt. They left the following day, 15 Nisan, and we are told the progress of their journey in Numbers 33:1-8. The first night they camped out at Succoth. The next day's march took them to Ethan, the next to Migdol on the evening which began the 17th day of Nisan. Pharaoh's heart was again hardened and sent his chariots after the Hebrews, arriving just as they reached the shores of the Red Sea. Pharaoh thought he had them trapped, but God placed a pillar of fire between the Hebrews and Pharaoh's army. Then on 17th Nisan, God parted the waters of the sea, and the Hebrews escaped to cross it. When the last Hebrew had reached the far shore, God let the Egyptian army follow to their death, as he allowed the waters to swallow them up completely. The probability of two events happening on the same day is calculated by multiplying together. 1 out of 360 times 1 out of 360. Remember, you never multiply the numerator times the numerator. And if you do, if it's 1 times 1, it's going to be 1, not 2, guys. So, you're not going to change the 1. 360 times 360 is 129,000. So, 1 chance in 129,000 that these two events occurred by accident on the very same day. So, it's like, and these are very important events, so, listen. The third event, the Hebrews entering Egypt 430 years before. This should really be the second event, but the Bible gives us, if it's us after the crossing of the Red Sea. Exodus 12:40-41 says, "Now the sojourning of the children of Israel who dwelt in Egypt was 430 years. And it came to pass at the end of these 430 years, even the selfsame day it came to pass, that all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt." By the way, when you say it came to pass, you know, it never came to stay. Never mind. It was not until the Hebrews traveled through the parted waters of the Red Sea that they physically left the land belonging to Egypt. So this was 17 Nisan. The scripture tells us that exactly to the day, 430 years before, the 70 members of Jacob's family had entered Egypt. This would also have been the 17th day of Nisan. Again, we multiply the individual probabilities together to get the calculation of the three separate events happening on exactly the same day. 1/360 × 1/360 × 1/360 equals 1 chance in 46,656,000. So, can you begin to see God's hand in the precise timing of things and his control over everything that happens in the world? The fourth event, the walls of Jericho. After the Hebrews had wandered in the wilderness for 40 years, and the generation which had rebelled against God had died, God allowed the tribes to enter into the land which he had promised to the seed of Abraham. Much had happened during these long years. God had fed them with manna and had led them with a pillar of fire by night and a cloud by day. He had given them his laws and the Ten Commandments. But in several occasions, he had come close to destroying them in anger, and only the pleading of Moses had changed God's mind. The tabernacle had been constructed and was carried with them to be pitched wherever they camped. The Ark of the Covenant contained the stone tablets of the commandments, a bowl of manna, and Aaron's rod, which had budded. The priesthood had been established, and leaders among the 12 tribes had arisen. They had started out from Egypt as a rabble. Now they were a nation. Just before entering the Promised Land, Moses had died, forbidden by God to enter. Joshua had been selected by God to lead them across the Jordan to their new land. And just as they had left Israel with the miracle of the Red Sea parting, they entered Canaan by another. God caused the Jordan River, which was in the spring flood stage, to stop flowing and allowed them to cross over on dry land. So Passover is always, so they eliminated Jericho. See, Passover is always celebrated on 14 Nisan. Let us follow what the scriptures tell us happened day by day after that. And they did eat of the old corn of the land on the morrow after the Passover, unleavened cakes, and parched corn in the selfsame day, Joshua 5:11. This had been 15 Nisan, and we are told what happened the next day, the 16th day of Nisan, or whatever. And the manna ceased on the morrow after they had eaten of the old corn of the land. Neither had the children of Israel manna any more, but they did eat of the fruit of the land of Canaan that year, Joshua 5:12. The corn which the scriptures speak of is not what we call corn, but type of cereal or grain. We are told what happened next, and this we must take a step of faith, for although the names seem to be following one another, it is not specifically told to us. But the next passage, Joshua 5:13, tells us that Joshua went to look at the walls of the city, and when he lifted up his eyes, he looked and saw a man with a drawn sword in his hand. Joshua went up to this man and asked, Art thou for us or for our adversaries? The man replied, Nay, but as captain of the host of the Lord am I now come. The angel of the Lord gave Joshua detailed instructions on what the Israelites must do to conquer Jericho, culminating with the walls of the city falling down flat to give them entrance to it. And although it would be 7 days before this would be accomplished, on this day, which would have been 17 Nisan, Jericho was given into Joshua's hand. For many years, there has been a dispute among archaeologists about the biblical account of the fall of Jericho. Excavations have revealed many cities had been built and destroyed on the site, which was probably the oldest city in the world, with Neolithic settlements dating back as far as 8000 BC, which there is no 8000 BC. But the recent publication of any article by noted archaeologist Dr. Bryant Wood has revealed compelling evidence that the Bible is indeed correct in what it says. This and some interesting scientific data, which may indicate that God used to crumble these walls in the means of stopping the flow of water in the Jordan River, will be discussed in a later chapter of this book. Again, calculating the probability of four events occurring the same day of the Hebrew year, 360th, times 1/360th, times 1/360, times 1/360, 1 out of 16,796,000. We're getting kind of low, okay? Anybody knows if you multiply decimal times decibel, proper ratio times proper ratio, or fraction times fraction, it'll get lower. Of course, it won't get lower than zero, though. It's still going to be something, but it's going to get lower and lower. It's kind of crazy why it never gets to zero, but, you know, it's almost like it tries not to. Fifth event, the cleansing of the temple by Hezekiah. I thought this would be a little shorter, but, you know, I'm glad it's not, okay? We need all this. The next happening, which God tells us about in His Word, took place about 800 years after the Israelites had entered the Promised Land and conquered it. The time of the judges had passed. Saul had been made king, then David, then Solomon, who had built the beautiful temple for the Lord. But Solomon, despite of all of his wisdom, had taken on the gods of the foreign wives he had married and displeased the Lord. When Solomon died, the kingdom was divided between his two sons, his two morons, more like. Then came a period of evil kings and the worship of the Lord in the magnificent temple had ceased. Israel, the northern kingdom, was the first to feel God's wrath, and he raised up the Assyrians to be the agents of his anger. Tiglath-Pileser led his Assyrian army against Israel and took captive back to Assyria the tribes of the northern kingdom. Judah, the southern kingdom, was temporarily spared. In Jerusalem, the beautiful temple lay in disrepair. These magnificent buildings dedicated to God were now used as garbage dumps, with the porches and hall choked with refuse and waste. I don't know if it's refuse or refuse. Refuse. Usually when I make it out, it's refuse or something like that. Or abstract, you know, instead of abstract, whatever. Ahaz, the king of Judah, took the silver and gold from the Lord's treasury and sent it to the king of Assyria as a bribe. And the Assyrians did not attack Judah. But the Lord looked upon what Ahaz did as evil, not respecting the treasury of the Lord, not depending upon God for protection against his enemies. When Ahaz died, his 25-year-old son Hezekiah became king of Judah. This young man worshipped Jehovah, and his first concern was to cleanse the temple in Jerusalem. Let us follow the biblical account of what happened and on what days these events occurred. By the way, Hezekiah made a big mistake. If he had not lived 14 years longer, he wouldn't have had Manasseh, the worst king that ever lived. Probably besides Herod. I don't know which one was worse. Manasseh, the 12-year-old king. Hey, I'm 12. But if he had not lived 14 years older, you see, God knows what he's doing. He knows what he's doing. But he let him. And just like he lets a heathen let into a lie, he lets his own children let into a lie. If he has to, he just puts them to the test. In 2 Chronicles 29, 1-28, we are told that on the first day of the first month, Nisan, Hezekiah's servants began to cleanse and sanctify the temple. On 16 Nisan, they completed the cleansing. Then on 17 Nisan, the sacrifice and worship again began in the temple. To calculate the probability of all five of these events taking place on the same day of the Hebrew year, we multiply 1/360th times 1/360th times 1/360th times 1/360th times 1/360th equals, drum roll. I'm not very alternative. I cannot do that. 6,048,617,600,000. We are getting kind of low. I mean, this is getting pretty desperate. I don't know how. All right, the next one's kind of long. Let me see. The sixth event, Queen Esther saves Hebrews from extermination. The next event takes place about 200 years later. Much has happened in the meantime. After Hezekiah, there had been many evil kings of Judah, and people had again forgotten their God. The Babylonian Empire had arisen and defeated the Assyrians. Nebuchadnezzar had brought his army to Jerusalem and taken the city, destroying Solomon's temple, and taking the Hebrews back to Babylon into captivity. Then the Babylonians had fallen to the Medes and Persians. Cyrus had allowed the Hebrews to return home, but many were satisfied to remain in Persia. From the family of one of those who chose to remain came the young woman who would become Queen Esther, wife of King Ahasuerus, better known by his Persian name, Xerxes. Robert W. Fade often wondered why the Book of Esther had been included in the Bible. It is the only book in which God is not even mentioned. Perhaps it is included because this story relates to another extremely important event which occurred on God's special day, the 17th of Nisan, and tells how a courageous Hebrew woman saved her people from extermination at the hand of an anti-Semite named Haman. It's interesting why he didn't do it for one, history, and two, numerology. Numerology takes a big part in the Bible. I don't know if this really relates to numerology, this part. The 17th day of Nisan sure is. Maybe the probability isn't, but the probability is pretty low. It's pretty low that this numerology couldn't be in there. One of the Jews who chose to remain in Persia was a man named Mordecai, and he was guardian of his brother's daughter named Hadassah. Mordecai had a mortal enemy. I'm sorry, my tongue is getting twisted. Mordecai had the mortal enemy, one of King Xerxes' court advisors, a man named Haman. I still couldn't get it. Oh my goodness. Mordecai had refused to bow down to the presumptuous and vain Haman, and the king's advisors swore that someday he would kill Mordecai. Xerxes had a beautiful wife named Vashti, and one evening, during a drinking party with his cronies, the king began to brag about how beautiful his wife was. You gotta be careful what names they are, because Joel, in the Bible, his official name was Joel, and his family name was Vashti. Oh, Vashni. Yeah, you can't get people different. You can't get people mixed up. Vashti was a woman, the wife that got thrown out, and Vashni was Joel. So, Xerxes had a beautiful wife named Vashti, and one evening during a drinking party with his cronies, the king began to brag how beautiful his wife was. At least it wasn't going how beautiful he was. Apparently, after too much wine, Xerxes decided to show her off to his drunken friends. He and Xerxes sent a servant for his queen to come and dance to show off her beauty. The servant went to Vashti's apartment and gave her the king's order. Now, this was in the days when a woman was the personal property of her husband, and he could do anything with her he desired. A wife was expected to obey her husband's orders immediately, and to refuse would mean death. This was especially true of a king's order, for the king held the power of life or death over all his subjects. But Vashti refused. Xerxes, of course, had been humiliated before his friends. There could only be one punishment, and they all expected Vashti to be executed. The next morning, after Xerxes was sober, he was sorry that he had caused this incident, but the queen must be punished. Not to do so would make the king an object of scorn to his friends, though none would dare to do this to his face. Vashti must be punished. But Xerxes loved his wife and could not bring himself to order her execution. Instead, he divorced her and ordered her banishment. This left the king without a queen, a situation which had to be remedied. His advisor suggested that the fairest of all the virgins of the land be found. By the way, there's something funny. You know, when I was seven, when I was still watching VeggieTales, we found an old tape. It was VeggieTales' version of Esther. It's so funny. Like, the reason why Vashti was thrown out was because she wouldn't make her husband, the king, a peanut butter and jelly sandwich at 3 a.m. That's why she got thrown out. Okay, I don't know why I remember this stuff, but I was 7. I might have been 6. Anyway, alright. Why did I tell you that? After proper instruction and preparation, the king would spend the night with each of the finalists and choose his next queen from among them. The king readily agreed. Mordecai's niece, Hadassah, was very lovely, and one of the king's selection committee saw her. Now, I could go on a long time on the story of Esther. You read it yourself. Now, let us trace the progress of the events which have followed. We were told in Esther 3:12 that the king signed this edict on the 13th day of the first month, Nisan. Esther fasted and prayed for 3 days, and we are told in Esther 5:1 that on the third day, 16 Nisan, the queen put on her royal apparel and stood in the inner court where the king sat on his throne. This was dangerous for her, for to enter this court uninvited could mean death. Anyway, the story goes, you know, Haman builds a... You know, she told Haman that she would do the thing the next day and the next day. This would go with Haman's plan to kill Mordecai, so, you know, Xerxes, you know, tricked Haman into helping, giving Mordecai royal apparel. Esther was able to give Xerxes the plot, and Haman was hung on the gallows, I think. Haman was a type of the Antichrist, pretty sure. Yeah, he was. The king's edict stating that all the Jews were to be slaughtered on the 13th and 14th of the days of the month of Adar was rectified. To this day, the Jews celebrate those days as the Feast of Purim. During this feast, Jews are encouraged to curse the memory of the man named Haman for what he had tried to do to them. But Queen Esther, a beautiful Jewish maiden whose name was really Hadassah, meaning Myrtle, had saved her people from destruction. That was on the 17th day of Nisan. So 1 out of 360 equals 1 out of 2 quadrillion, 177 trillion, 42 billion, and 436 million. Getting on some astronomical numbers for the probability of all these events happening by chance on exactly the same day of the year. Do you think that perhaps God's hands just might be on this? Just might. The seventh event, the resurrection. Jesus was crucified on Wednesday and arose from the dead early on Sunday morning. at sundown on that day, on that Wednesday, Passover began. We know that the Passover is always celebrated on the 14th day of Nisan. Wait a minute. On the 14th day of Nisan. Just a minute. Sorry, there's a typo too. Yes. Jesus was in the tomb for 3 complete days and nights in order to fulfill his prophecy concerning the sign of Jonah. On that first Easter morning, when the most important event in history happened, he rose from the dead on the 17th day of the Hebrew month of Nisan. 1 out of 360 times 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 1 out of 360 equals 1 out of... Okay, so that means the probability of all 7 events happening by chance on the same day equals 1 chance in 783,684,876,960,000,000. It went from 129,000 to 784 quadrillion. Guys, I don't think. I'd say 17 is an important number, and I'd say numbers alone are important. Now, I don't recommend his book. He has a lot of errors in it. He says that it's actually wrong that God's name is Jehovah. I call that a heresy. So don't trust everything he says. I don't recommend the book. I'm just reading parts of it, and I don't even know if he's completely correct. But and most in the other cases, he's smart. He was a Christian, but he thinks it was Yahweh. That, oh my goodness, that I think even that can send somebody to hell. Or just somehow. I mean, you get saved the same way, at least in the church age, you know. But someone gets the Yahweh, they start saying Yahweh, they don't get anything from God. I don't know, it's just not reliable. This guy isn't exactly reliable. Well, at least he gave it to us when he said, I guess God doesn't mind us calling Jehovah, but it's really Yahweh. Oh, at least he gave us that one. Well, anyway, I was just reading the good parts of it. So, if you think the Bible was written by primitive people, you need help. Thank you so much.